This is being recorded on July 8th of the year 2001. It's a two-half-hour segment series. We're going to begin with a small article from the New York Times of Saturday, June 30th of the year 2001. There has been an appointment by George W. to the National Security Council, and this is sort of an example of deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra would have put it, to veteran students of the Reagan and Bush administrations. This will be as familiar as it is perhaps nauseating. It's also interesting to ruminate about this particular appointment against the background of the furor over Bill Clinton's pardon of Mark Rich, an event about which I have more questions and answers. More about that in a minute. This is an article special to the New York Times, Dateline Washington, June 29th, headlined, Iran-Contra Figure Back at White House. It reads in part, Elliot Abrams, a prominent figure in the Iran-Contra scandal of the 1980s, was appointed to President Bush's National Security Council on Thursday as the director of its Office for Democracy, Human Rights, and International Operations, officials said today. Mr. Abrams, a former Assistant Secretary of State under President Reagan, pleaded guilty in 1991 to two misdemeanor charges of withholding information from lawmakers who were investigating the Reagan administration's clandestine efforts to support Nicaraguan rebels, Contra rebels, despite a congressional ban. He was sentenced to 2 years probation and 100 hours of community service, but was pardoned by President Bush's father in 1992. Well, Elliot Abrams was a key player in the Iran-Contra affair. The fact that he was charged and ultimately pleaded guilty to two misdemeanors is in and of itself obscene. What's worth noting is that he was pardoned by Bush's father in 1992, one of a number of key players in the Iran-Contra scandal to be so pardoned. There was nowhere near the outrage demonstrated by the media over the elder George's pardoning of a bunch of his criminal associates in the Iran-Contra affair. This was done shortly before the trial of Caspar Weinberg, the former Secretary of Defense, was set to begin. One of the things that was so significant about Bush's pardoning of these Iran-Contra scandal players was that George Bush himself was implicated in the Iran-Contra scandal in a profound way and might very well have faced indictment. Indeed, in his book Firewall, former Iran-Contra special prosecutor Lawrence Waltz discussed the fact that George Bush himself was in fact in the loop and that in all likelihood he would have been indicted himself. I would also note that there was the mainstream media obsessed with Bill Clinton's pardon of Mark Rich, something I'm not crazy about. It's also something I have more questions and answers about, particularly in light of the fact that the BCCI investigation, which had its final report delivered at about the same time that Mark Rich was pardoned, named Mark Rich as a player in obtaining agricultural credits. This apparently used in the funding of Iraq. I discussed that at considerable length in a For the Record program. Specifically, that would have been For the Record program number 2... Oh, off the top of my head, I've forgotten, but let's see, 281. It was in the 270s or 280s, and think of the name. Think of the number later on in the broadcast. It'll come to me, but it's called Rags to Riches, and it's about the Mark Rich case. Interestingly enough, Mark Rich himself had as an attorney Louis Libby, who is Dick Cheney's chief of staff. Recently, the FBI, which has been under fire in a number of different contexts, has undergone a change of leadership. Louis Freeh, the director of the FBI, stepped down, and he has now been replaced, at least assuming that Robert Mueller's his nomination is confirmed, which in all likelihood it will be. Robert Mueller actually pronounces his name Mueller. Last name is spelled M-U-E-L-L-E-R. Mueller himself is an interesting fellow, and as head of the criminal investigation section of the Department of Justice under George I, he oversaw some very interesting cases which have connections to the Iran-Contra scandal. Oh, by the way, Rags to Riches is For the Record program number 277. I knew the number would come to me. The following is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, July 6th of the year 2001. This is a Chronicle story by Zachary Coyle, C-O-I-L-E, and Bob Egelko, or Egelko, E-G-E-L-K-O. Its headline, SF Prosecutor Mueller Picked to Lead FBI and Mend Its Image. And in a sidebar to this article, there's discussion of some of the top cases that Mueller oversaw. It reads, while he was head of the Justice Department's Criminal Division, Robert S. Mueller III oversaw several high-profile matters. The prosecution of Panamanian strongman Manuel Noriega on drug charges, the inquiry into the 1988 bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, and the BCCI investigation, a huge international fraud case. Three of these, the three that I just named, impinge directly not only on the Iran-Contra scandal, but also on the overlapping Iraqgate scandal. And one of the things that's significant about these cases is that had they been investigated to the full, to the extent that they might have, these almost certainly would have brought down George Bush, certainly led to his impeachment, if not his ultimate conviction on criminal charges. The lead paragraph of this story, by the way, reads, President Bush tapped Robert S. Mueller III, the U.S. attorney in San Francisco, as the new director of the FBI yesterday, seeking a no-nonsense manager to repair the image of an agency accused of botching several recent high-profile cases. And we're going to chat about BCCI in a minute. More about the BCCI case, this from an article in the Chronicle the preceding day. This is from Tuesday, actually 2 days early. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, July 3rd of the year 2001. This is an article by Stacy Finns, F-I-N-Z, of the Chronicle. It's headlined, In the Running for FBI Director, subtitled, Bush Considers Low-Key SF Federal Prosecutor for Job. And of the BCCI investigation, by the way, the BCCI was called the Bank of Credit, was the abbreviation for an institution called the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. This was nicknamed the Bank for Crooks and crooks and something else. Anyway, WAGS gave it a different name. BCCI was heavily involved not only with some of the funding of the Iran-Contra scandal, but also served as a vehicle for the repository of drug money and also for the funds used by various terrorist groups as well. Again, it was deeply involved, and the BCCI was deeply involved in the Iran-Contra scandal. Oliver North used an account with BCCI for many of his machinations. And BCCI is an institution with, as I like to say, more connections than a switchboard. More about BCCI in a minute. Skipping down in this story, from Boston, Mueller went to Washington, D.C., where he served as the head of the Justice Department's Criminal Division in George Bush's administration. It was there that he oversaw the prosecutions of Noriega and headed up investigation of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International scandal, a huge fraud case in which people throughout the Third World lost their life savings. By the time the BCCI probe picked up steam, several Washington power brokers were implicated, and allegations surfaced that the Justice Department was balking at the investigation because of alleged CIA links. By the way, those alleged CIA links are they're a matter of public record. Continuing, then Representative Charles Schumer, Democrat of New York, fired off a report critical of the Justice Department's treatment of the case, saying the failure to pursue wrongdoing might be because too many prominent politicians had connections to BCCI. Quote, there is possibly a cover-up or conspiracy, unquote, Schumer, now a U.S. senator, said in 1991. Again quoting, but it is also a 50% chance that it was just ineptitude, a failure to go after white-collar crime. Well, I suspect that there was a whole lot more to it than that. Again, BCCI was centrally involved in the Iran-Contra affair. It was one of the many connections that would have undoubtedly led back to the elder George Bush, who was not only was in the loop, but was the main orchestrator of the Iran-Contra affair. The vehicle for realizing the Iran-Contra and Iraqgate machinations were the intergovernmental agency networks that were put together pursuant to the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism that was headed up by George Bush, and the networks that were created out of the recommendations that task force put together were utilized by George Bush as sort of his own private intelligence service. They were the main vehicle for the realizing of both the Iran-Contra machinations and the Iraqgate machinations, and had the BCCI affair been properly investigated, it would have gone back to the elder George Bush. It also, as we're going to talk about in a minute, might have very well gone forward and tarred the current George Bush, George II, with the very same brush. I would note in a couple of different For the Record programs, For the Record program 249 and also in number 228, I went into a meeting that took place in July of 1986 between George Bush, that's the elder George Bush, and Amiram Nir Nisker, and also military intelligence agent Charles McKee, who was in charge of a group of U.S. military intelligence operatives who were in the Middle East looking to free the hostages that had been held as part of the imbroglio in the Iran-Contra affair. The McKee team died in the bombing of Pan Am 103, and indeed it has been established that the U.S. State Department had advance warning that a Pan Am plane was going to be blown up, and indeed the evidence in the bombing of Pan Am 103 not only does not point exclusively to Libya, but the larger view of the investigation points in the direction of Manzar al-Qassar, a Syrian terrorist and weapons trafficker who was a main operative in the Iran-Contra affair, and who was alleged by the Pan Am 103 insurance investigators report to have been the principal executor of the Pan Am 103 bombing. That Pan Am insurance investigators report also alleges that the handlers for Manzar al-Qassar had advance warning that the bomb was going to go off and that they deliberately prevented the flight from being canceled and therefore bore responsibility for the bombing of Pan Am 103 and the elimination of the McKee team, who were alleged by the insurance investigators report to have come across the connections between the Iran-Contra players and Manzar al-Qassar. I believe it was Oliver Buck Revelle's son. Oliver Revelle was a former FBI official also involved with the investigations of Iran-Contra, and some would maintain that he helped to attenuate some of those investigations. But Revelle's son, I believe, was going to be on Pan Am 103. He was one of a number of people who was able to cancel his seat on that particular flight. The McKee team were not so lucky, and again, it is alleged that it is alleged in the Pan Am insurance investigators report that the McKee team had come across the connections between Manzar al-Qassar and the Iran-Contra player, and that they were headed back to the United States to, among other things, blow the whistle on that particular connection. It's been established and again discussed in For the Record 228 and 249 that George Bush was in a meeting at the King David Hotel in Jerusalem in July of 1986, at which the aforementioned Charles McKee and also Amiram Nir Nisker, one of the Israeli players in the Iran-Contra affair, discussed some of the machinations. Lawrence Walsh, the aforementioned Iran-Contra special prosecutor, was interested in investigating this particular meeting. It was one of the areas of stonewalling that helped to frustrate his investigation. And again, had that particular meeting been properly investigated, it might very well have led to the impeachment, perhaps even the criminal conviction, of the elder George Bush. Certainly, Charles McKee was present at that meeting, and his death in Pan Am 103, or on the Pan Am 103 flight, precluded any testimony that he might have given either about that meeting or about the alleged discovery of the Manzar al-Qassar Iran-Contra connection. Manuel Noriega's involvement with Iran-Contra and with the Bush milieu, the elder George Bush milieu, is a matter of public record. And one of the things that's interesting about the BCCI connection is that one of the people involved with the milieu of the BCCI was a fellow named James R. Bath, who, by his own account, allegedly was recruited by the elder George Bush into the Central Intelligence Agency and assigned to babysit some very wealthy Saudi Arabian clients. James R. Bath put up approximately 5% of the working capital that went to found Arbusto Energy, George Bush's first oil company. That's George II, W's first oil company. And as we've discussed in numerous broadcasts, For the Record program number 256, the aforementioned number 277, broadcast number 249, and For the Record program number 186, the acquaintances of James R. Bath at the time said that he had very little money of his own, so in all probability, the capital that went to found, that portion of the capital that went to found Arbusto Energy probably came from James R. Bath's wealthy Saudi Arabian clients, who included the Bin Laden family, because James R. Bath was the Texas business representative for the Bin Laden family. Osama Bin Laden is the terrorist extraordinaire, and his operatives are alleged to have executed the bombing of the destroyer Cole during the course of the campaign last fall, and the bombing of the destroyer Cole was among the factors that helped to make the Clinton administration and, by extension, Al Gore look weak, soft on terrorism, incapable of dealing with these Middle Eastern Islamic fanatics who were raising hell with American lives at the same time as the price of oil was going up. Essentially the same double bind that we saw in the year 2000, when a combination of rising oil prices, resulting inflation and economic hardship, and the seeming impotence of the United States in the face of the Islamic militants in Iran and the taking of the hostages helped to send Jimmy Carter's presidency to the happy hunting ground. One of the interesting things about the BCCI connection is that had it been properly investigated, it might very well have gone to James R. Bath, revealing his business connections with the Bin Laden family, and ultimately it could have seen to it that George W. would have been blocked from reaching the heady heights that he currently occupies. Of course, George W. is currently a heartbeat away from the presidency. Feeble heartbeat under the circumstances, that of course being Dick Cheney. Again, I would note that Bill Clinton took a lot of heat for pardoning Mark Rich. In the aforementioned For the Record program number 277, there's discussion of the fact that the Senate Foreign Relations Committee's report on the BCCI listed as among the points to be investigated Mark Rich's use of agricultural credits in the 1980s through BCCI. Agricultural credits were the main vehicle for accomplishing the funding of Iraq, that funding of the weaponry that Saddam Hussein came into possession of, one of the major factors, the central element in the BNL or Iraqgate scandal, also overseen by the elder George Bush. Speaking of the bombing of the destroyer Cole, allegedly or ostensibly performed by the operatives of Osama bin Laden, we read the following from the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, June 20th of the year 2001. This is an article by Diana Elias of the AP. It's datelined Kuwait and headlined, "Islamic militants brag they bombed warship Cole." It reads in part as follows. Islamic militant Osama bin Laden's Afghanistan-based group boasts in a recruitment videotape that its followers bombed the destroyer Cole in Yemen's Aden Harbor last year. The video, circulating among Muslim militants and viewed here yesterday, would represent the clearest link yet between Osama bin Laden and the October 12th attack that killed 17 American sailors and wounded 39. But bin Laden himself does not specifically make that claim on the tape, and has not accepted responsibility in the past. Well, the final determination vis-a-vis the bombing of the destroyer Cole, again, something that certainly made the Clinton administration and by extension Al Gore look weak in the eyes of the American people, again, the impotence in the face of international and Islamic terrorism, et cetera, in combination with rising petroleum prices, was essentially the same double bind that helped to do in Jimmy Carter in 1980. So with the appointment of Robert Mueller, we have somebody whose pursuit of some of the national security-related investigations leading in the direction of both Georges Bush, particularly the elder George Bush, was, shall we say, less than vigorous. I would also note that as George II took office, the leadership of the FBI has changed, and a number of things have come to light that have made the position of Louis Freeh very uncomfortable. Of course, the revelations concerning the Robert Hansen spying case helped to embarrass the FBI in conjunction with a number of other things that had gone on in the last 10 years. I also wonder about the surfacing of the documents about the Oklahoma City bombing and Timothy McVeigh. Those documents surfaced just before Timothy McVeigh's scheduled execution date. I think it is most unfortunate that McVeigh was executed, and that the many, many evidentiary tributaries vis-a-vis the Oklahoma City bombing leading in the direction of a much more complex, a much broader milieu than just McVeigh and Nichols, both of whom I believe were involved, but who were only two relatively low-level players in a much wider scenario. I think it is most unfortunate that McVeigh was put to death. He might have gone to his death a stoic, good soldier, but after 30 or 40 years in prison, he might have come to rethink some of his actions and might have ultimately revealed more about the Oklahoma City bombing than he will certainly be revealing now. One of the questions I have, and I want to stress that this is a question that I have, not a statement that I'm making, but I wonder whether, in addition to its own obvious missteps, I wonder whether perhaps the FBI is being destabilized. This will appear crazy to uninitiated listeners, but it has been my contention for some time now that, in fact, one of the things bedeviling the United States, in addition to its own miscreants and certainly the ineptitude that is in no short supply within elements of the U.S. government, I think that the United States itself is in a state of destabilization and is being subverted by a fascist-slash-Nazi fifth column, not unlike the way the French government was subverted prior to World War II. One of the reasons why the numerically superior French military succumbed so quickly to the Nazi invasion, the French elite, in many ways, were more sympathetic to Nazism and fascism than they were to the social front of Léon Blum. I suspect, and it has been my contention, my belief for some time, that the United States is also in a state of advanced subversion, as insane as that will undoubtedly appear to uninitiated listeners. I believe that the U.S. itself is being subverted from within, and I believe that one of the institutions that is being so subverted is the FBI. And this is not to say that I have any illusions about the FBI. There certainly is no shortage of incompetence or malfeasance that the agency is engaged in over the decades. However, I would also note that the FBI and the federal government in general has been one of the major targets of the racist right, particularly in the wake of the conclusion of the Cold War. And one of the questions that I have concerning the FBI's missteps and its declining image is whether, in addition to its own ineptitude, which is certainly present, and in addition to its own missteps, which are certainly a matter of record, I wonder to what extent the FBI is being deliberately destabilized in order to weaken it and to open the country up for further fascist subversion. And again, I wonder about the surfacing of the McVeigh documents, the Robert Hansen spying case, and the resignation of Louis Free, and whether perhaps, and again I stress perhaps, these were being deliberately orchestrated in order to effect a change of leadership at the FBI and to put someone in charge of the Bureau, which is obviously the Federal Police of the United States, who would be far more sympathetic to covering up the stink that grew during the presidency of the elder George Bush. I really believe that the elder George Bush was a three-time U.S. president. I think he was the real power behind the throne when Ronald Reagan was on the throne, and of course he had his own administration. And one of the questions I have about Robert Mueller, again an individual whose pursuit of Bush-related investigations has been less than vigorous in the past, I wonder whether perhaps it was deemed necessary to get someone in charge of the FBI who was more sympathetic to the machinations of the Bush family than Louis Free might have been. Again, that's a question I have, not a statement that I am making. However, in connection with the alleged Osama bin Laden connection to the USS Cole, the role that appears to have played in the 2000 campaign, and the recent shakeup at the FBI, one should perhaps consider the following. This is from the Wall Street Journal of Friday, July 6th of the year 2001. This is an article by David S. Cloud and Neil King, Jr. It's Dateline Washington and headlined, U.S. Faces Hurdles in Approach to USS Cole Probe, and it reads in part as follows. When a senior Federal Bureau of Investigation official sought recently to go to Yemen, scene of last year's deadly terrorist attack on the warship USS Cole, he ran into an unlikely obstacle, U.S. Ambassador to Yemen, Barbara Bodine, B-O-D-I-N-E. With the Yemenis complaining of too many FBI agents in their country, Ms. Bodine took the unusual step of denying access to John O'Neill, the hard-charging supervisor of the case who normally works in New York, according to two officials familiar with the decision. FBI brass appealed to Ms. Bodine's superiors, but her decision was allowed to stand. Skipping down, the FBI pulled all its investigators out of the country last month, that would have been June, after receiving what it called a specific and credible, unquote, security threat. Well, I don't know precisely what that specific incredible security threat was, but I would note with the James R. Bath, George W. Bush, Arbusto energy connection to BCCI and to the Bin Laden family, and with Robert Mueller's position as a less than vigorous investigator of Pan Am 103 and BCCI, both of which would have brought down the elder George Bush, and the BCCI investigation might very well have brought down George II as well. I wonder about the State Department role in the attenuation of the FBI's investigation of the USS Cole. And I wonder about the changing of the guard, so to speak, at the FBI in connection with the bombing of the USS Cole. And I strongly encourage members of the listening audience to consider the hypothesis that I've been advancing on and off over the years, that for all of its shortcomings and for all of its misdeeds, the FBI and other aspects of the U.S. government are in fact being subverted from within. And again, the operant paradigm is one of comparison with what happened in France prior to the Second World War. That has been my belief for some time, and it's something I think listeners should examine very critically. And again, this is not to say that I hold a brief for any mistakes and or deliberate misdeeds of the FBI. I don't. But one should consider the degree of hatred that is felt by international fascist elements, particularly domestic fascist elements, toward the FBI, and consider the role that necessarily the FBI would have to play in any successful interdiction of fascism in the United States, and consider what has been going on at the FBI, and consider to what extent that those changes and some of those misdeeds may have been the result of deliberate subversion of the Bureau from the inside. One of the things to consider in connection with George W. is the extent to which the media themselves are not only soft-peddling George W., but in fact are directly connected to people who have a vested interest in the Bush administrations. One of the key campaign officials in the election of the elder George Bush in 1988 was Roger Ailes. Roger Ailes is now head of the cable network for Fox News Corporation. And there was a recent puff piece in the New York Times about that, about the Fox News Corporation. That in turn has been followed by a more critical piece that has been put out by Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And the FAIR report on Fox News was the subject of a Chronicle op-ed column, that San Francisco Chronicle op-ed column, put together by William German and headlined, "Good Guys on Cable TV." This is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, July 6th of the year 2001, and in discussing the Fox News channel, it notes, "In the 65 million households where Fox News and CNN compete in prime time alone, Fox is winning by nearly 30%, unquote. And skipping down, "Fox News Corporation President Roger Ailes was for decades the most pugnacious Republican of all, did all the dirty work, i.e. Willie Horton, and knocked out 1988 Democratic presidential nominee Michael Dukakis." But also note that Roger Ailes was for many years one of the top people involved with producing Rush Limbaugh's program. And again, he is one of the top campaign officials for the elder George Bush. And the head of the political desk at Fox News was, the fellow who occupied the political desk at Fox News was none other than John Ellis, the first cousin of Jeb and George W. Bush, and it was John Ellis who reversed the call of the state of Florida from Al Gore to George Bush, thereby leading the media stampede that ultimately caused Florida to be successfully crunched for George Bush. We're going to be discussing the milieu of Bush, as I call it, the Bush League, in the second side of this program. I've made allusions to other broadcasts that I've produced over the years. Those are distributed by a tape duplication and CD distribution service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179. That's P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. By the time this program goes out to the member stations that carry it, there will be a lengthy and annotated description of For the Record program number 310 available in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. www.radiotopia.com. Sister station WFMU is compiling real audio archives of the For the Record programs on two websites. One of them is at wfmu.org/Dave Emory, DaveEmory. The other, archive.wfmu.org/archive/D#X/. There are links to both websites on the Spitfire website. That concludes Side A of For the Record Program number 310, Bush League. This is being recorded on July 8th of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.